I'm Alex Michelson. This week on The Issue is Governor Gavin Newsom talks about homelessness, takes on L.A. County, and talks about the presidential race. Plus, a conversation with Senator Marie Alvarado Gill, who just this week went from being a Democrat to a Republican. She gives us her first interview. Then, a conversation with Adam Schiff, who is very much a Democrat, running for U.S. Senate, member of the House. He talks about his what happened with Joe Biden getting off the ticket. And finally, a conversation with Brian Tyler Cohen, author of the new book, Shameless. So a lot to get to, a lot that didn't end up on the TV version just because of time. So you're getting a lot of extra content in This Issue Is podcast. But let's start with Governor Gavin Newsom. We met up with him in Mission Hills, where he was cleaning up a homeless encampment and expressing frustration that after the Supreme Court gave counties and cities more latitude to clean up encampments, L.A. County has expressed an unwillingness to do so and really a protection for those who are living in those encampments, saying that they don't want to send any of them to jail, at least not most of them. The governor fighting back. Here's some of that conversation. What's the message out here today?
Well, I don't know. The message is we continue to struggle to clean the state up, period, full stop, to deal with health and safety, to deal with the number one complaint that's universal up and down the state, not just people live here, but people visit here. And at a certain point, people, you know, they're ready to turn the page on folks like me. They've had it. And they're not interested in how much money we're spending. In fact, I think it's becoming more obnoxious the more we say we spend, and yet the results are not what they expect. And so, look, I'm just, instead of preaching from Sacramento on my desk with a suit and tie, this is probably the fifth or sixth time we've done this together over the last few years. This is not a stunt. This is what I do consistently. But right now with that executive order, I hope people understand I'm done. And I'm not going to continue to make the investments, unprecedented historic investments from the state level, unless I see the results at the local level.
You put out an executive order getting encampments off of state ground, but strongly suggesting to cities and counties that they do their part. Are you satisfied with what cities and counties are doing? Because a place like LA City, LA County, kind of pushing back on what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, cities, I've been pretty impressed. Counties, no. Counties have been, you know, there's a diffuse nature of leadership in a county. You have multiple members of boards of supervisors, mayor, there's one person accountable. I think Mayor Bass has done a wonderful job. She's been a great partner. You're seeing that down 10.4%, over 10% decline in unsheltered homeless population last year. So that's progress. But I'm not seeing that at the county level. And with all due respect, there's no more excuses. Everything the cities and counties have asked for, the state of California has delivered, and the Supreme Court just delivered. So there's no more excuses. So where's the urgency? Drop everything else. Get out there and address the number one, two, and three issue in this state with an intensity of purpose. That's the kind of action I want to see. And again, for me, if we don't see it, it's not complicated. We're not going to continue to make the investments in communities that aren't willing to do their part. I will redirect those dollars to counties and cities that are doing their part. And so that's clear.
What does that look like exactly? LA County, the biggest county in the state, one out of four people live in LA County, and a lot of the county leaders are pushing back on this. So what does that mean for this place?
Well, I mean, LA County can right now move forward with our conservatorship law. They refuse to do it. LA County right now could significantly increase the number of people getting support under the CARE Corps. Unprecedented support into the county, billions and billions of dollars over the last few years. And yet we're seeing the same excuses I've seen for decades. And again, it's not an indictment. These are my, I say this sincerely, like this is not a fake political thing. Actually, my friends, this is not an indictment of them. It's an institutional construct where people are acting as like they're victims. And they've been using every excuse in the toolkit. I'm just done. Drop everything else. Get out there and address the number one issue in the state, in this county, in this region. And across the state, again, it's not just about LA County. But to put out a resolution right after I did an executive order, you better believe I paid attention to that. And I'll be paying attention to that in January, and I'll be paying attention to that every single week in between now and January, because I want to see results. People deserve results. People deserve to get off the streets and sidewalks. There's nothing about this as humane. There's nothing about this as healthy. People are dying on their watch. They're dying on their watch. There's nothing compassionate about this.
And what do you say to people that we spent $24 billion on homelessness and the problem's gotten worse? I know you're frustrated by that, but what do you say to residents who have had enough as well and don't trust the state?
Exactly. Well, the state is doing work it's never done in its history. This is not the state's role and responsibility. It never has been its history. It's the county function. As a former county mayor, I intimately understand that. I never looked to Arnold Schwarzenegger to fix it, and we never looked at the state. I recognize the state needs to do more, and we've done just what the cities and counties have asked for. So all I say is we want to see results. I share that frustration. I want to see results. I want to physically see the streets cleaned up. I want to see encampments removed. I want to see it done compassionately. We're not criminalizing poverty, just the opposite. But what is criminal is the neglect. You can't square the rhetoric of compassion with the reality of the feces and the urine and the needles and the fact that people don't have a place to go to the restroom, let alone to get a warm meal.
And in terms of the national politics, news today that Donald Trump is agreeing to a debate with her. What would your strategy be or advice in terms of debating Trump and your thoughts on Tim Walz?
Well, I think Kamala will clean his clock. And I think it's pretty clear that he's looking at the clock and he's panicking. And that press conference was just about panic. He knows he's starting to lose. Momentum's completely shifted. His rhetoric is becoming increasingly stale. He's on the ropes. Just a week ago, said, I will never debate on ABC. Now he says, well, I'll do ABC, NBC, and Fox. It's just the guy's all over the place. He's got to regret his vice presidential choice. And Kamala Harris got a great vice presidential choice. And so I worry about how unhinged he can get over the course of the next few months. And I'm just grateful he's not the president of the United States, just a candidate.
And just real quickly, Panda. It's Panda Day. You were just at San Diego at the National Zoo. We were in China helping to negotiate this sort of thing.
Thank you.
Did it mean to you to see the pandas?
Well, as I said at the press conference today, it wasn't about the pandas. It was about what the pandas represent. If we can save the pandas, maybe we can save ourselves. If we can reconcile our differences as it relates to helping each other on biodiversity loss, on the climate, maybe we can also address the friction and all the stress that we're feeling between our two nations. I said it again, you heard me say it in China, divorce is not an option. And we just have to define the terms of our strategic red lines and our engagement moving forward. But at the end of the day, it's people to people, and it's about respect and understanding. It's about capacity to learn from one another. It's about cultural exchanges. And to me, today represented that.
Great to see you, Governor. We'll see you in Chicago at the DNC.
See you in Chicago. You don't want to shake my hand, yeah. So I'll just take a fist bump.
All right.
Now to our conversation with the California State Senator, who this week changed parties. Here's that.
Senator Marie Alvarado Gil is here with us on The Issue Is for her first interview since making the switch. Thanks so much for being here.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So why switch from Democrat to Republican?
Well, first and foremost, it was the right thing to do. I've been a Democrat my whole adult life. My first vote as an 18-year-old new voter was as a Democrat. And I'll just tell you, Alec, the Democratic Party of today is not the Democratic Party that I signed up with as a new voter. It has changed. The pendulum has swung so far to the left that it has disengaged from what true Californians value, our middle class values, our families, our diversity in California. And frankly, I just could not support an ideology over the will of the people.
So why did you become a Democrat in the first place?
Yeah, well, I took a civics class, just like many of our seniors. And I was listening to my duty as a U.S. citizen to be able to vote and express my voice. And I was inspired. I was inspired by having an impact in my local community and statewide.
So what was the moment where you decided, I can't do this anymore, right. I need to be a Republican?
That's right. So, you know, this is not a decision that I took lightly. This is definitely something that I reflected on and I prayed on. And the reality is this. In California, we have seen the pendulum swing so far in the areas of crime, homelessness, and for so long in public education. So before coming into office, I was an educator in charter schools, and I selected that path because I knew that we were leaving too many kids behind here in California. We have succumbed to a public education system that it is okay where kids don't read and write by third grade, that we have to actually have statewide goals. We have not made even a dent in public education to say that we can even be in the top 10 of the US. Now, for me, it really is about looking at where we are right now. The supermajority has the power in both the executive branch and the legislature. But what I'm missing is that will to change, that will to ensure that Californians across our state are taken care of.
You know, there clearly are many of your constituents who voted for you as a Democrat. They're
That's
expecting
right.
you to serve out your term as a Democrat.
That's right.
What do you say to them?
Well, you know, my constituents, first and foremost, were part of this decision that I made. I've been listening to them for the past 2 years, serving my district that is predominantly a Republican district. I've been serving as a representative of the values of our district and a representative of what means the most to our constituents, whether they're Democrats, Republicans, or no party preference. Now, for me, I came in as a beneficiary of the open primaries. So this was a seat that has not been held by a Democrat in over 30 years. And in the general, it was a Democrat on Democrat race. Now, I came in as a moderate. I've always held moderate values, and I've swung a little bit moderate right. So now, seeing how the inner workings of the majority party work in Sacramento, I have to step back and say, is this good not only for my constituents, but is this good for Californians? And my answer is no.
What was the biggest surprise about the way it actually works inside that maybe you didn't think until you got there?
Right. Well, you would think with a supermajority, there would be more ideas and more impact and more influence on the decisions that were being made. But the reality is there is a select few within that supermajority that makes those decisions. And we saw it play out with the Prop 47 initiative. You remember that, Alec?
Yeah. So the Prop 47, of course, this effort on whether to reform it, Prop 47, which basically decriminalized a lot of different bills many years ago.
That's right, yeah. Including adding to the retail theft problem that
right.
we have here in California. So we have looked at this for years. We knew it was a problem. We knew it was an escalating problem. But you have to ask yourself, why does the supermajority take a position only in election years? Because if we know it's a problem and the supermajority has the ability to impact change, why not do that for the good of Californians? So what we saw was an initiative of the district attorneys organizing with our sheriffs across California and saying, enough's enough, we're going to bring a ballot initiative forward and take it to the voters. And we know what the voters are saying is enough. Crime has increased in our communities. Homelessness has increased in our communities. And this is all under the Democratic supermajority. So we have to identify that there's a problem there.
And that's Prop 36 is going to be on the ballot in November. You're supporting that, I'm guessing?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I was one of the first legislators, the first Democrat, to withdraw my name from a bill package that was accompanied by a poison pill, is what we call it, which is essentially eliminates the power to be able to implement some of these regulations. So essentially, we as legislators have that ability to implement laws, but this was actually poisoned by a very small few within the supermajority, and I said, absolutely not. I would not put my name on that, and I would not bring that to my constituents.
You know, there's an argument that being in the majority gives you more leverage and more power,
right.
and that you actually cannot serve your constituents
yeah.
as effectively
right.
being in the minority. What do you say to that?
So this is my belief, Alec, that we are elected to serve our district, whether we are Democrat, Republican, or no party preference. My district has all different party affiliations. Because I was a Democrat did not mean that I can only serve and represent Democrats. That is not what democracy is about. So I have taken the position of true representation. By moving from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, I am sending a message. I am sending a message to every Democrat who is wondering what has happened to the Democratic Party of today. And do my values align with the Democratic platform of today? And if the answer is no, Alec, it takes courage to step away from what you have known, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, this is a courageous step in the right direction as a true representative of California and the values that lead us here in California.
This is Alex Michelson on The Issue Is. We are talking with Senator Marie Alvarado Gill. Senator, you had to talk to the Democrats about this.
I did.
Mike McGuire is the leader for the Democrats. He's the Senate President Pro Tem. We have a picture of you with him.
That's right.
You've worked with him closely in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a statement from him in terms of his response. He says, quote, "This is disappointing to voters who elected Senator Alvarado Gill as a Democrat. They trusted her to represent them, and then she betrayed that trust. Senate Democrats continue to work on their behalf and deliver results for rural California." Can you take us inside the room?
Right.
What was it like when you told Senator McGuire, "I'm leaving the party"?
Right. So, you know, this for me is, it was a personal decision, and I took that personal decision to the pro tem as a courtesy to say, this is where I am, this is where my district is, and frankly, I need to step ahead in what people like me here in California, we are thinking this already. Mm-hmm. We know that the Democratic Party doesn't represent us. And for me, this is that courageous step to say, it is time to make this change. Now, Alec, this has never been done before, so we didn't have a precedent to be able to say this is the right way to do it. But what I did, was follow my values, mm-hmm. follow what I know was right for California. And whether that means that I would get pulled off committees, as you know, I'm chair of Human Services, more than likely come Monday, I will not have that position. There may be some other repercussions. We know that there is a punitive element to leaving the supermajority. But I'll tell you, I have a lot of respect for Senator McGuire, for Pro Tem McGuire, because he has led the party to his best of his abilities. And I've seen him over the decades that he has led, and understand that, you know, he may be disappointed, but the sense of betrayal, that's where I disagree.
Was he angry? Was he surprised? What was the reaction from him?
You know, it was a cordial conversation. This element of betrayal, you know, I want to speak a little bit to that, because in essence, there is a deep betrayal in the majority party. And I don't know if you knew this, Alec, but we have these great affinity caucuses. One is the Latino caucus that endorsed me to run for this position. But did you know that if you're a Republican or even an independent, you cannot serve as a leader or even be a member of that Latino caucus? And this has been, this has happened for years. We have tolerated this, that we have caucuses and committees that only represent the supermajority. Well, that's not all of Californians. And that's certainly not the values that we say everyone in California have.
I'm sure it was a more pleasant conversation with Senator Brian Jones, who is the top Republican in the California Senate. We've got an image of you and him in the past working together, because you're such a moderate. You've worked with both leaders in the past. Senator Jones put out a long statement on X. The end of it was this: for anyone else who might be tired of witnessing the supermajority ruin this state, run the state to the ground, we have a seat at the table for you too. What was that conversation like when you went in and talked to him?
Yeah, I have a lot of respect for Senator Jones. You know, he did counsel me to make sure that this was the right decision for me. He knew it's the right decision for California. But, you know, again, this hasn't been done before. So for me, I'm very excited to join his caucus. We are the minority caucus, but there is a clear plan on fixing California. And there is that tenacity, that will to fix California. So we may not be the majority, but we definitely have the solutions that will take us into the areas of fixing California.
Have any of your other Democratic colleagues thought to do something similar?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not going to speak for them, but I'll tell you, there are Democrats that think the way that I do, either moderate or center-leaning Democrats. And there may be some decisions that they need to make in terms of their own values and the direction that they see California going. Because ultimately, this is a position of public service. And this is about serving our constituents, serving California in a way that helps the future of California. Not us personally, not the special interests. And Sacramento is overthrown by special interests now. Mm. And so I hope that my colleagues will take this as a sign, as a message, that it is okay to step out of the status quo and do what's right for California. Because as leaders, that is ultimately what we were elected to do.
So you're not on the ballot this year. You're next up in 2026. Are you going to run for re-election as a Republican?
I am going to stay a Republican until I am put in the ground. I am committed to this. You know, I talked to my husband about this last week, and he says, you know, I've never been married to a Republican. And so I said, and you're never going to be divorced from a Republican either. So, you know, we have some fun with it. But, you know, the reality of this, Alec, is this is a commitment. I am fully prepared to jump into that commitment. And as of this week, I've been welcomed by my colleagues in the Senate and in the Assembly, central committees throughout my district. And I'm just excited to kick this off.
And obviously this happens in the midst of a crazy presidential race, a crazy presidential week.
That's right.
Harris versus Trump, who are you supporting?
Well, you know, that's the question of the day, right? So for me, I'm going to be watching both of our candidates very closely between now and the election. And for me, I'm really looking at someone who can embrace the diversity of our country and lead us into the next generation.
We know so much about both of them. Who is that at this point?
Well, you got to see what I have on the ballot. I'll see you in November. We can have that conversation.
Well, we know who's on the ballot. It's going to be
back.
Harris versus Trump.
We'll see. We'll see which box I mark.
Although,
but I'll be back to talk to you about
although
that.
Although we don't know maybe what will be on the ballot because we thought it was going to be Biden versus Trump.
Yeah,
so thanks.
I'll tell you, things change.
To your point, things change. We thought you were Democrat
last week,
so
things
you never
change.
Know. I guess that's true. All right, we're going to end with something fun here on the show. We play something called Personal Issues.
All right.
This is 30 seconds to get to know you. Your cultural favorites.
Okay.
First thing that comes to mind.
Right.
Here we go. What is your favorite TV show?
TV show, Big Bang Theory.
Favorite movie?
Movie, The Godfather.
Favorite musical artist?
A musical artist. You know, I like musicals, so when you said that, The Sound of Music came to mind for me, but that's not an artist.
Okay, we'll
right?
go with Julie Andrews.
Okay, there
favorite
we go.
Sports team?
Oh, you know. Gosh, Bay Area fans are going to come at me, but I'm a Raiders fan, and I'm sorry they left California, but everyone's leaving California.
Yep. Well, not everybody. Who is your role model?
My role model is my grandmother.
Why is that?
My grandmother raised me. I was very young when I was separated from my parents, and she took me in, and she introduced me to community, to the church. And she also taught me what it meant to be a very strong entrepreneurial woman. And it is her that I, I dedicate my success in life. And, you know, I talk to her still now that she has passed, but she is definitely still part of me.
What do you think she would think of you becoming a Republican?
Oh, she would say, ay, mija, estoy muy orgullosa de ti. She would say, you know, my daughter, my hija, I'm very proud of you.
All right, Senator, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thank
Great
you.
Talking with us.
Thank you.
From the new Republican to an old Democrat, our conversation with Adam Schiff, where we discuss, among other things, his role in what happened with President Biden getting out of the race and his significant space in making that happen.
And joining us now is the congressman from Burbank and the current frontrunner to be the next U.S. Senator from California, Adam Schiff. Welcome back to the show. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
All right. So let's start with the big breaking political story. Who is going to be Kamala Harris's VP? You've said that the decision really isn't so much about chemistry, but about who can help her the most and when it comes to winning the election. So is that person the governor of this biggest swing state of all, Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro?
It very well may be. If he can deliver Pennsylvania, and he's very popular in Pennsylvania, then that's worth the price of admission. There are obviously a number of other really talented candidates, Tim Walz in Minnesota, Mark Kelly in Arizona, among others, that also bring help in Midwestern states or in Arizona. But Josh Shapiro, if he can deliver Pennsylvania, that alone is huge.
All right. So we'll see what happens in terms of that. Now, we haven't talked with you since you made global headlines by suggesting that President Biden drop out of this race, which is why Kamala Harris is making this decision now. Here's some of what you said at the time. While the choice to withdraw from the campaign is President Biden's alone, I believe it is time for him to pass the torch and in doing so, secure his legacy of leadership by allowing us to defeat Donald Trump in the upcoming election. Can you take us behind the scenes on how you arrived there and whether you've spoken with President Biden since then?
I haven't had a chance to speak to the president since then. And it was hard to get to that point because I have such admiration for him. He's been an incredibly accomplished president, doing more in one term than most ever do. And more than that, I just great affection for him. But I did come to the conclusion that it was best that he passed the torch. That we needed someone with the vigor of Kamala Harris to prosecute the case against Donald Trump. I worked so hard to hold Trump accountable for his various abuses of office and in criminality, for that matter, to not do everything I could to prevent him from returning to the Oval Office. And I know that if I hadn't said something and we had sort of walked into an electoral nightmare, I would have kicked myself later. So I did speak out. As I said from the beginning, I was confident Joe Biden would make the decision that was best for the country, and I think that's exactly what he's done.
Were you in communication with former Speaker Nancy Pelosi during that process?
You know, it's interesting. There's been a lot of commentary about that, that I was essentially, as one commentator described it, one of Nancy Pelosi's drone, like an unmanned aerial drone. I did not consult with her before I made the statement that I did. I certainly have a very close relationship with her. She keeps her cards very close to the vest, particularly on something like this. So she kept her own counsel about what she was discussing with the president. But I know that she was hearing from members, including myself, but others from, you know, battleground states or in tough House races, who are deeply concerned about the direction we were heading in. And I'm sure that she communicated those concerns as she heard them from our caucus.
You know, most political reporters found that very hard to believe, the idea that you weren't in communication with her. I mean, so you're saying you did this completely on your own without any consultation with her?
I did it on my own. I didn't consult with her before I made the statement or even decided to make it public. And I know that is hard for some people to accept because we are very close. But I, you know, I wanted to respect her decision-making process. I didn't want to, you know, put that burden on her to tell me, go, no go, this is what you should say, this is not what you should say. I think from her point of view, this was a deeply personal decision for all of us to make about what we thought was best for the country and whether we felt compelled to speak out or not. So I didn't want to put her in that position.
You talk all the time about the importance of democracy. We know that 3.2 million Californians voted for Joe Biden in the primary. Yes, they knew that Kamala Harris was his vice president, but they didn't vote for her at the top of the ticket. How is it democratic for the Democratic Party to unanimously nominate someone who no regular voters actually voted for?
Well, the way the process works is we vote for people to represent us at the convention to cast their vote along the lines that we would like. And that's what would have taken place at the convention, but for the decision Joe Biden made to step aside. And now he made the recommendation to the convention, but it was only a recommendation that we get behind the vice president, but we very quickly closed ranks behind the vice president. But that is the way the democratic process works. And it works that way in part for a very significant reason, and that is circumstances change. And, you know, it became, I think, clear to the president that it was the right time to pass the torch to his vice president, and that's what he did. But I think that is certainly consistent with the Democratic Party functions and the way we vote for delegates at the convention. We follow the appropriate process.
A big issue continues to be jobs and the economy. Last week, President Biden said this.
The economy.
I mean, he may have been a little bit joking there, saying that he cured the economy, but the latest unemployment number is actually up, with June employment revised down by 29,000. The stock market, we've seen these wild fluctuations there. Inflation remains an issue. What do you say to Americans who feel right now that Bidenomics isn't working for them and they want to change?
Well, first of all, you know, the president did create millions and millions of jobs, 10 to 15 million jobs under his watch, compared to Donald Trump, who lost net jobs when he was president. So he has a record to be proud of. At the same time, so many people are working but still struggling to get by, and both can be true at the same time. This, to me, is the central economic challenge, not just of these days of inflation, but going back decades, and that is people year after year are working harder than ever and struggling more than ever to get by. Now, a lot of this is the fact that the way our economy has evolved with globalization, automation, increasingly with AI. If you're doing well, you're going to do even better. And if you're not, you're going to fall further behind. We need to make the economy work for everyone again. And there are lots of ways to do it. I'm focused on bringing down the cost of housing, which is one of the primary inflation drivers that makes it so hard for people. The only way we're going to really succeed in attacking that problem is by building hundreds and hundreds of thousands of units of new housing in California every year. And I'm working on dramatically expanding the tax credits to develop affordable housing, because right now it's not penciling out. But local governments are going to have to help. They're going to have to get to yes on these decisions much more quickly. We can't take 4 years to build new housing. We can't spend $1 million a door to build affordable housing. We're going to need to work together at the federal, state, and local level to solve that part of our economic challenge.
And obviously, you want to be doing this work in the United States Senate. You're in the middle of a Senate race right now against Republican Steve Garvey, and you're really dominating in the recent polls. Let's look at the Real Clear Politics average of recent polls. Shows you up 58.5 to 35.5. How would you characterize your place in this race right now? And because of those numbers, will you be spending significant time and money campaigning for other candidates in the months ahead?
Well, look, my feeling is run scared or run unopposed. That is, unless you're lucky enough not to have opposition, I've never been in that kind of position, you run hard, and I'm running hard. I'm running harder than Steve Garvey. I'm traveling all over the state. He seems to be conducting what used to be in the last century called a front porch campaign, where you sit in your front porch and you wait for people to come to you. No, I'm going all over the state. And while I do that, I am, like I was just the last 2 days, spending time in those House districts in California that if we can flip, we can change the majority in the House of Representatives. So I was in Orange County just in the last 2 days, campaigning with two of our Orange County Democratic candidates. I was in the North of the state campaigning with another. And I am going to do my best to help these other senators in their races and to help the vice president. I was in Nevada for a day campaigning for her. As long as I can do that with at the same time running a vigorous race in California, then I want to help others as well.
You know, Steve Garvey did make a big deal about the fact that he traveled and visited Israel. And he said that he's with Israel yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Do you have any issues with the way that Israel has pursued its war with Gaza?
Look, I'm glad that Steve Garvey went to Israel, but I think Steve Garvey feels that making one trip to the Middle East somehow makes him now an expert on the Middle East, and I would quarrel with that that kind of presumption. But look, I support Israel's right to defend itself. They were brutally assaulted by this terrorist organization, Hamas, which butchered, massacred, raped, tortured 1,200 people, including Americans, and still holds Americans and Israelis and others kidnapped and holds them captive. So we need to defend our ally. At the same time, we need to do everything we can to reduce civilian casualties in Gaza. That is a humanitarian imperative. We have to make sure that people can access food and medical supplies as well, and I don't think those are incompatible. But I've got plenty of issues with Bibi Netanyahu. I did before the war. I certainly do during the war. And I don't minimize those either. But from my point of view, it's an important state-to-state relationship. This is our strongest ally in the region. It needs to transcend whoever the prime minister is and whoever the president of the United States is, for that matter.
You know, you were part of a massive Zoom call for Kamala Harris called White Dudes for Harris. It was a big success, raised over $4 million in a night. But why the need to do White Dudes for Harris or Black Men for Harris or Latino Men for Harris? Why not just Dudes for Harris or People for Harris?
Oh, I mean, the whole campaign is People for Harris. So all of that is happening. When I was in Nevada, for example, something for her earlier in the week, it was, anyone, everyone for the vice president. But it got started when Black women wanted to do something special for Kamala Harris. And then white women wanted to do so, and then white dudes wanted to do so. And it's not uncommon for political campaigns, Democratic or Republican, to have events that are focused on a particular community. What is unusual, though, is to see the kind of massive interest in participating. I mean, to get, 100,000 or 200,000 dudes or anybody, frankly, on a Zoom is pretty unheard of. But what was best about it, Alex, and you'll appreciate this, is we had the dude on that Zoom. That is Jeff Bridges, the Big Lebowski.
Of course, I knew you were going to say that, which is why I have the video ready to go. I knew that would be your favorite part. The dude from your favorite movie, The Big Lebowski. What was it like for you to be on that call with him?
Oh, it was terrific. It was such a great surprise. And Alex, you'll forgive me if I told you the story already, but I was in the Oval Office about 2 months ago for a bill signing. with President Biden. And when the signing was done, he quoted some movie, which I didn't recognize the reference. And he told me he likes to quote movies and often his staff doesn't recognize the reference. And I said, I do the same thing. But I said, Mr. President, I want to quote a movie in the Oval Office and make Lebowski history when I say, looking at that beautiful oval rug in the Oval Office, Mr. President, this rug really ties the whole room together.
Did he get it? Has Joe Biden seen the Big Lebowski before?
He certainly laughed. Whether he understood the reference, whether he's a Big Lebowski fan or not, I cannot speak to, but he did crack up.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you all win, or even during this administration, maybe you got to find a way to bring Jeff Bridges to the Oval Office to show him the rug, and then maybe you can really bring that thing full circle. Congressman,
you told me to take any rug in the place.
Yeah, exactly. Congressman Schiff, great to see you. Thanks so much for coming on.
Great to see you.
Our thanks to Adam Schiff. Now to our conversation with Brian Tyler Cohen. Let's start, though, with a clip from Lindsey Graham and an ad from the Lincoln Project.
The leader of the Republican Party, Donald Trump. He's the most consequential Republican since Ronald Reagan.
He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot. No, I don't think he's a xenophobic, race-baiting, religious bigot.
You know what concerns me about the American press is this endless attempt to label the guy as some kind of kook, not fit to be president.
I think he's a kook. He's not fit to be president of the United States.
He's a jackass.
Yeah, I like the president.
I'm saying my party is completely screwed up.
And you could use my words against me and you'd be absolutely right.
Well, that Lincoln Project ad featured in the new book, Shameless, Republicans' Deliberate Dysfunction and the Battle to Preserve Democracy. It's by Brian Tyler Cohen. Brian is a progressive YouTuber whose videos have been seen literally by billions of people. He is the host of the No Lie with Brian Tyler Cohen podcast. Brian Tyler Cohen, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Always great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And just for full disclosure to people, I met you through this show and you have become one of my best friends.
True.
And we are so proud of you for this book. Oh, congratulations.
Thanks.
It's great and so excited for you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this was the first show that I was on and that's thanks to you. So I'm really glad. I'm grateful for being here, but also your friendship. So
talk to people. What is Shameless? What's the basic point?
The basic point is that for so long, Republicans have operated under this guise of pretending that they are something that they are very clearly not. And so there are a lot of branding points that they use, that they're pro-Constitution, pro-family values, pro-states' rights, pro-fiscal responsibility, pro-law and order. And what I try to do with the book is prove that that is expressly not the case. And in fact, they're relying on this branding to give them cover to behave in a way that's completely antithetical to that branding itself. And in large part, the media has helped them perpetuate this farce. And then finally, what Democrats can do to rebalance the political landscape moving forward.
Yeah, and so you point to a lot of different examples, but one that's pretty glaring in terms of being shameless is the way that Mitch McConnell handled the Supreme Court when there was an opening with a Democrat compared to opening with a Republican.
Yeah, and I mean, that kind of puts it on full display. That was when the veil was really lifted for most people, that the rules don't even apply anymore. They're not looking to lend credence to any of their perceived ideals, and they're just kind of throwing that out the window and replacing it with just this shameless desire to consolidate power at any cost.
Yeah, basically he said when a Democrat was in power that they wouldn't hear, even have a hearing for a Supreme Court justice for an entire year. And then when a Republican had an opening, he did it with 8 days left when people were actually voting. And then he was confronted on this and basically kind of laughed.
Laughed it off.
And sort of made everybody know that he's in on the joke too.
Right, and that was the point at which they made it clear it wasn't even worth hiding anymore. He's gonna laugh it off in broad daylight, and so, you know.
So you lay out sort of the history of how this happened. Some of this was what was called the Fairness Doctrine back in the 80s, which meant that the media had to report both sides equally. That went out the window during the Reagan administration. In the 90s, you saw this rise of right-wing radio. Rush Limbaugh became hugely popular. And then you point to the Obama inauguration in 2009, and there's this meeting you write about led by Frank Luntz, Newt Gingrich, other Republicans, in terms of how they were going to treat this very popular new young president.
And that was the moment. I mean, the book is titled Republicans' Deliberate Dysfunction and the Battle to Preserve Democracy. But that was the moment at which the dysfunction did really become the point here, because What they decided to do with the help of Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich and all these Republicans in the immediate aftermath of Obama's election is decide that they are no longer going to help Democrats do anything to make sure that government can function. They're going to expressly be the party of no. And so they blocked everything from happening so that they can show their own voters that the government doesn't work. And it was the most cynical, it was the most cynical way to go about doing this, because what it made sure is that the government could never function again so long as Republicans have any power whatsoever to wield. And for a party that keeps beating us over the head with this idea that the government can't work, that actually redounds to their benefit, because they can break it and then point to the thing that they just broke as proof that it actually can't work. And so go ahead and elect the people who think that we should shrink government down to nothing.
So in 2012, after that, they ran Mitt Romney and they lost. And then they did this autopsy where they looked at the party and they realized that they were having a really hard time with Latino voters. So they thought the answer to that, the party did, was Jeb Bush, who was running for president, married to a Latina woman, very involved, compassionate conservative. They thought he was going to be the answer. And Republican voters said, not so fast. Donald Trump.
What about if we went with the guy who's doing the Muslim ban?
Yeah. Donald Trump comes down the escalator. He says, nope, doesn't listen to the party, runs against the party, wins over the support. How did Trump do it?
Well, I think he appealed to the worst instincts of a party that had been groomed thus far to recognize that really what their goal is in government is just to defeat the Democrats and to make sure that it doesn't work. I mean, that is the natural conclusion of what Newt Gingrich and Frank Luntz were seeking to do. It was to make sure that there was no cooperation, no compromise whatsoever. It was to defeat the enemies who were the Democrats. And then that Donald Trump, in large part, was a big part of the problem, but he was also a major symptom of a broader problem that had started years earlier.
But in terms of communicating, you say there are a lot of lessons that Democrats can learn from Donald Trump's effectiveness.
Yes.
What are some of those lessons?
And this is not to give too much praise to Donald Trump here. But look, he's been very effective in terms of wielding repetition, for example, wielding simple messages. I mean, how many times have we heard build the wall, lock her up, make America great again, beat over our heads over and over and over till it's seared into our cerebral cortexes, right? And so I think what we're seeing now is finally Democrats recognizing the power of repetition and the power of simple messages that can actually resonate with people. We're not going back is one of them that Kamala Harris has used over and over again. It's simple, it's to the point, it's evocative, and it's sticking. And I'm glad the Democrats are finally learning that lesson.
Well, because you interview Al Franken in the book, and yeah. He talks about sometimes the problem for the Democrats' bumper stickers are they need to say continue on next bumper sticker.
Right.
Basically,
right.
That the message is so complicated and so long that nobody can remember it. You are seeing this, we're not going back from Kamala Harris. You also see this word weird that's being used a lot, started by Tim Walz, who was chosen this week as the running mate. How is that connecting? Talk about what you're seeing online, because you look at the metrics online closer than anybody every single day. What's connecting in the Democratic base right now?
Well, there's two things. One is the fact that what we are seeing is weird. If somebody is so obsessed over what you do in your bedroom, if somebody's so obsessed over what you do in your doctor's office, if someone's so obsessed over what you read, what you learn in school, what bathroom you're walking into, that is weird. We would call it weird in our normal lives. If somebody said that they were doing that on an individual basis. So yeah, it's weird, and I'm glad that it's finally sticking. And to Democrats' credit, to the left's credit, we finally do have an ecosystem that is a little bit more organized, and we're able to combat what's happening on the right. What's also resonating is this idea that there's just hope right now in Democratic politics, and that's what we're seeing with Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. And for once, it's hard to do. To do the gloom and doom thing every single day and to try to get people excited to come out and vote as opposed to just staying at home when the message over and over is that we have to protect our democracy from its imminent demise. And so Kamala Harris has been able to wield this message of hope and what could be in the future. And I think that it's bringing a lot of people into the political process who clearly weren't interested in doing it before. She's landed a ton of endorsements that happened immediately. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's brought in a bunch of young people who kind of signed up to volunteer for the campaign immediately, brought in a ton of donations from people who are donating for the first time now.
What she hasn't done, though, is any interviews with mainstream journalists. She hasn't held a press conference. So far, it hasn't hurt her. But could there be danger in that long term? Mehdi Hasan, who you interview in this, talks about one of the things that Trump does so well is he floods the zone with so much content that you almost don't have an ability to stop and say, wait, that didn't make sense, or that might not have been true, because there's just so much coming at you that it normalizes all of it. When Kamala Harris is doing so few interviews, when she finally does do an interview or does a press conference, the stakes are higher. You think there's some danger in that?
I think with Joe Biden, there was, because it felt like every moment was especially precious. And the fact that there were so few interviews, the stakes were so much higher. Right now, Kamala Harris is reaching voters and she's talking to people out there on the campaign trail. She's talking to crowds of thousands or tens of thousands of people. So she's making her points especially clear. The second thing is that when Donald Trump does these press conferences, for example, in so many instances, we see him get away with just shoveling, to your exact point, all of these lies forward, and they're not being properly rebutted. And so if the media can't show that it deserves to actually sit down because it doesn't know how to differentiate truth or fact or fiction, then why should Kamala Harris be sitting down and rewarding these people with more time when they're already dropping the ball when it comes to Donald Trump?
Well, maybe because there's a responsibility to communicate with people and answer questions and show some deference to journalists and all that, and it's not just a propaganda machine and everything.
And she will. But for right now, I think it's important that she gets out there and kind of continues to harness all this enthusiasm that's just pervading the left. And it's been a long road, man. We deserve some joy in this.
Well, you talk about the fact that the Republicans have really dominated some of the old school media in terms of right-wing media on maybe cable TV and radio, but that TikTok is a place where a lot of the younger people are dominating, which is more liberal. We've got some facts this week. There was a company that actually tracked this sort of thing. I'm going to put this up on the screen. TikTok mentions this week. Kamala Harris, 82% positive, 17% negative. Donald Trump, 8% positive, 89% negative. This is a huge deal. Talk about how TikTok has the potential to totally change this race. And I think we're seeing it already.
Absolutely. The biggest generations that are up for grabs are young people right now. And especially with TikTok, the right had dominated TikTok up to this point. But I think that the point of positive versus negative is especially important because that is the campaign each of these candidates are running. Donald Trump is running a campaign predicated on demagoguery and fear and retribution and vengeance and, you know, don't let brown people come in because they're going to do X, Y, Z. And that's not the campaign that Kamala Harris is running. And there's only so much fear porn that you can take before it just becomes exhausting. Who is that going to energize by just making people afraid of leaving their houses every day? But then you look at what Harris and Walz are doing on a daily basis, and that is the promise of making sure that we have health care and codified abortion rights and gun safety reforms and just on and on. The list keeps going.
But don't you think that Democrats for years have run on fear of Trump, including you? I mean, hasn't that a lot of what you do every day, this fear of him?
Of course. And it worked in 2020 because the threat of Donald Trump was so pronounced and we were in it. But clearly it wasn't going to be potent enough to run in 2024 because we had Joe Biden and all we had was an anti-Trump campaign. Biden, for as great a president as he is, he wasn't a good candidate. He wasn't able to prosecute that case against Donald Trump. So all we had was the fear of Donald Trump because there was no other argument on the other side.
Chris Matthews in Hardball years ago wrote about usually the candidate who looks like they're smiling when you think of them as a smile on their face ends up winning and connecting with people. And right now, when you look at almost every image of Kamala Harris or Tim Walz, they're smiling. And Donald Trump, you never really see him smile.
In fact, that's so obvious that the attack that a lot of the right is using against Kamala Harris is that she laughs too much.
Yeah, because people don't like laughing.
Yeah.
So in terms of sort of where we go from here, what do you think is the most effective messaging going forward as somebody who works on this every single day?
I think it's multi-pronged here. First of all, there is, of course, the issue of protecting abortion rights, and I think Kamala Harris is especially well-positioned to be making that argument. She's been crisscrossing the country for over a year, talking to young people about how important it is to protect reproductive rights. Meanwhile, you've got someone like Donald Trump on the other side who brags about the fact that he appointed a third of the Supreme Court that overturned Roe. So there's that. Of course, the issue of democracy, but then there is the hope and joy of the prospect of a future that we can have in this country where it's not just doom and gloom, but instead protecting rights, expanding rights, making sure that people are safe and workers have some dignity in their work.
You're an author now. Congratulations on that title. I know you're an English major. This is something you always yeah. wanted to do. You have a book. Now, so much of what you do every day is catching people's attention literally in a second or two, knowing that that's yeah. all you have to get somebody's attention. And here you're doing a deep dive. Was it hard for you to focus on this? What was this process like of actually writing for you? Because I know you did it late night.
I did it late night. Most of my writing happened between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. So, yeah. So nice restful time. Yeah. I was writing this book. Yeah, it was difficult. Most of my scripts for that I write for myself for my YouTube channel are about 1,000 words. And so I remember after my first chapter, I have such muscle memory with these short scripts. And I wrote, got my first chapter down on paper. I was like, all right, we're done. I look down, we have 1,000 words, and I have 59,000 more. This is going to be a long road ahead.
Yeah.
But, you know, we got it. I made it work, and yeah, I'm happy with the way it turned out.
How does it feel for you to see it?
It's a little bit surreal, because to be honest, I've been approached a few times to write a book, and I'd said no every single one of those times, because I held these books in such high regard. And I mean, like you said, I was an English major, and so that was the top of the mountain for me. I mean, mm-hmm. for like a nerdy English major at school, like being able to write a book or publish a book is just, it's kind of like the dream, right? And so to finally get it done, it just kind of feels surreal, and it's very bizarre to see my name on the title.
Yeah, well, your name is right here on Shameless, but you also have different names of people that you've interviewed, most of whom have written books before.
Yes.
That have been on your show, no lie, and you went to them and asked them for insights, and their insights are full of here. So this book is broken down with a lot of these players in it. So to promote who you talk to, I thought it would be fun to play the name game,
okay.
Which is where we put up the name of somebody, and these are all people you talk to in the book, and the first word that comes to mind when you think of them, okay?
Yep.
So the first one is Congressman Jamie Raskin.
Oh, he is a hero.
Attorney Mark Elias.
He's an attack dog, and he's an attack dog.
Former Senator Al Franken.
Hilarious.
Commentator Mehdi Hasan.
Oh, a fighter. Thank God.
Pod Save America host Dan Pfeiffer.
Always right.
former White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Jen Psaki, the best press secretary we've ever had.
Professor Heather Cox Richardson.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. And truth teller.
Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg.
Pete is a rhetorical assassin.
Okay. And finally, your mom. One word that comes to mind for your mom.
Well, actually, and I talk about this in the book, but a voter, and that means a lot. My mom hadn't voted in 60 years, and surprised me. And I'd given up long ago trying to get my mom to vote, because if there's anybody watching and wants to, and understands the stubbornness of a Jewish mother, recognizes that I can say whatever I want, it's not going to persuade her to do anything. And I got a surprise text one morning during the 2020 election that showed her casting a ballot for Democrats.
Wow. So you couldn't convince her before that.
I convinced thousands of people way long after I gave up on trying to convince
my
mother.
So what do you think is the winning message for your mom and other people to convince them to actually get out there and do it?
It is that we have agency, and there is a reason that certain Republicans are trying so hard to prevent people from voting or to make you believe that you don't have agency, and that is because they know how much power each individual person has. I mean, these elections are won not by millions of people, not by hundreds of thousands, but tens of thousands, or in some case, just thousands of people. And so please, for everybody watching, make sure that you have a plan to vote, make sure that you're registered, and make sure that you have somebody in your life who wouldn't have otherwise gone and voted, and that they have a plan to vote as well.
And we want to encourage people to check out the No Lie with Brian Tyler Cohen podcast, which is usually hosted by you.
That's right.
But next week, you've got a special guest host.
Yeah, first time ever that this is happening.
Who is that?
That's going to be Fox LA's Alex Michelson. Very excited for it. And we're going to switch chairs here for the first time on my show. Alex will be interviewing me.
To do an even deeper dive on this book, if people can watch this whole interview as well on youtube.com/AlexMichelson. And they can come see you in person on Monday, August 26th. You're doing an event in Santa Monica with Jon Favreau, the host of Pod Save America. People can come see you, buy the book. How do they get involved in that?
So all you have to do is go to briantylercohen.com/book. There aren't many tickets left. Most of them have been sold, but there are a few. So if you'd like to come see it, so if you'd like to come see me and Jon Favreau, again, you can just check out briantylercohen.com/book and see you on August 26th.
And I'll be there in the audience. It'll be a lot of fun. All right, Brian, congratulations again.
Thanks.
We're so proud of you. Love you, brother.
Our thanks to Brian Tyler Cohen, to Congressman Adam Schiff, to Senator Marie Alvarado Gill and to Governor Gavin Newsom. A lot this week on The Issue Is. Next week's going to be a big one. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker Emerita, coming in studio for a special half hour next week on The Issue Is. Thanks for listening this week. Let me know what you think of the show. Let people know what you think of the show as well. I hope you can share it out. I'm Alex Michelson. Have a great week.